This is the News and Talk of Nevada. Now, Bosma on Business with award-winning entrepreneur Mike Bosma. We're getting Northern Nevada back to business on News Talk 780 KOH.
Good morning, Reno. It is Mike Bosma, your business savvy CPA. Indeed, each and every Saturday morning, take care of your business. Indeed, 10 to 11 on Saturday mornings, KKOH.com. If you want to check out this prior radio shows, yes, it's Bosma on Business. You Garden Show listeners, you want to hang in, hang tough, because we're going to be able to help you not only make a buck this next hour, but also take some of that produce and make alcohol with it. Yes, a little Christmas cheer. In studio, we've got Matt Levitt, founder, CEO, chief cook, and bottle washer for Tahoe Blue Vodka. First and foremost, Matt, welcome to Bosma on Business.
Mike, thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Oh, glad to have you. So one of the people I've been able to come to know over the years, Matt has had a great success founding a vodka. So being able to have the best tasting neutral grain vodka, get your mind around that. It's neutral. It's not supposed to taste like anything, but mine tastes the best. Figure out how to do that. But it's all made out of different kinds of produce. So you Garden Show listeners, you want to stay tuned, figure out how to make a buck out of the cabbage. Different kind of cabbage, Matt.
That's right.
All right. So first, I want to kind of start off our show just welcoming in the Christmas season for you business owners out there. Would be remiss if I did not let you know that there's some significant planning things that you need to be aware of. We're going to hit that on the top of the second segment, so definitely stay tuned for that for year-end planning 101. Then also be able to kind of learn how to scale your business on segment three. So without further ado, Matt Levitt, founder, CEO of Tahoe Blue Vodka. Give us your business model. We call it the elevator pitch.
All right. So Tahoe Blue Vodka is a completely different approach to vodka, both from the manufacturing side and on the distribution side. As you said, it's neutral. And yes, the more neutral, the better. And the better premium vodkas have less and less taste, typically. And Tahoe.
Yeah, because the stuff, the lighter fluid that I was familiar with when I was young, it may not have a taste, but it had a kick. It packed a punch.
Plastic bottle.
Right.
The old plastic bottle, the one that was on the knee-high shelf at the store, right?
Right.
We're up at eye level nowadays.
Gotcha. That's the premium ones on
eye level. That's right. Premium vodka. So most vodkas are made from grain, and grain vodka has this classic antiseptic bite, lighter fluid aftertaste that you just kind of pointed to. And what most companies are doing is they're distilling their vodka over and over again and then using that as a selling point when really it's a necessity, right? Because what they're making is unpalatable to start with. This basically, it's just cheap grain vodka. And a lot of consumers think of vodka as being potato.
Right.
And it was in Eastern Europe 100 years ago.
Czechoslovakia, Poland, right. Russia, right?
Right. But here in the U.S., we're making our vodka out of the crop that's most readily available, most abundant, and least expensive, and that's grain usually. So they're starting with this grain vodka, they're distilling it over and over again, and then they're selling 6 times distilled or 10 times distilled as a feature and benefit of the product. What we did, I sat down with our master distiller and said, hey, I want to make this vodka that's clear, pure, and smooth like Lake Tahoe, that has no bite, no aftertaste, really tastes better than all those other vodkas. The master distiller suggested this approach of blending, and you see blending a lot in whiskey and scotch and more in wines. Mm-hmm. And the idea there is you can highlight certain characteristics of some of those ingredients that you like while masking the less desirable characteristics. So in this case, what he suggested was, let's take some grain vodka to give it structure, to give it the body that we're used to tasting with vodka, but mix some slightly sweeter vodkas in on the back end before the distillation, and then ultimately achieve better results more quickly with fewer distillations, smoother vodka. So he suggested this grape, corn, and sugarcane blend. I sat down and worked out the ratio with my team, which is 50% sugarcane vodka, 25% grape vodka, 25% corn vodka. They're distilled separately, blended together, and then distilled again 2 more times. And that blending process quite simply makes it taste better.
Cool. So one of the things that I'm fascinated with is, like, most people, when they think grapes, they think wine, but you decided, hey, let's make vodka.
Right. They take those grape skins and
has that happened before?
Has
other distillers created vodka out of grapes?
Sure. There's a couple on the market, but they tend to be pure grape,
okay,
not blended. The blending
so
thing is
sweet,
really
then, right?
It might be too sweet, for example, for a martini or to go into a savory drink.
Right.
And so that was the idea with going with a little bit of that sweet vodka and a little bit of that grain vodka. So we're distilled three times. Tahoe Blues entered a bunch of spirits competitions and come home with awards, trophies, and medals and all those, and eight of them to be exact, and really was ranked best unflavored vodka in the world in the Ultimate Spirits Challenge in New York, where we beat Belvedere and Chopin and American Harvest and a lot of other big name brands that were distilled more times than we are.
Okay, cool. And I would imagine that licensing was a big part of this thing. For some reason, I'm thinking J. Edgar Hoover. You don't want the FBI coming, coming to your doorstep. What do you need to do to get licensed to be able to distill vodka?
That's right, and you absolutely want to stay on the right side of the laws. So, and here's where our business is different from a lot of the other businesses. We're not actually a licensed distillery. We contract the distilling out to another small business, a craft distillery, that does that for us. Because of that relationship, we're able to self-distribute, which gives us a big advantage in the marketplace. We self-distribute on the California side. We use Southern Wine and Spirits here in Reno and on the Nevada side. But in California, where the bulk of our market is going to be developing over the next few years, we have complete control as to how we sell it, where we sell it, who we sell it to. We don't want to just dump our product off at any gas station or dive bar, right?
Right.
There's the right customer, the right consumer base.
Right, that consumer base that's like on that plastic bottle vodka, probably not the right customer base for it.
Those are not our people.
Right.
That's right.
They're like, why is this so expensive? I could buy this by the gallon.
That's right. And so what we've done really is we've built our own distribution company, which is really, again, very unusual as the blending. We're the only spirits competition that I'm aware of that's done this. And so we have our own salespeople, we do our own delivery, we do our own merchandising, stocking, building the displays at the stores, we do our own printing of our table tents and drink menus. That's really top to bottom distribution company.
Well, and it's interesting because I'm very familiar with the space, and distributors, as people go to market, they think, hey, this is great. I just have to create the product. I'll just get plugged into a distributor, and then they're going to do all the quote-unquote work to sell my stuff. Well, guess what? You know, you're one in a laundry list of other spirits that their salespeople are trying to get shelf space for, get display space for. And by and large, you got to kind of have your own sales force or truly incentivize people to be able to get your stuff top of mind rather than just in a laundry list of other stuff that's being sold. So it's a very antiquated model, but it is nonetheless the prevalent one. And if you go into the alcohol business, to be able to work with a distributor to sell your stuff. And everybody I've ever talked to that is in your space, Matt, is they're equally frustrated and in awe of how they're like, I'm giving a certain percentage of my profits to this distributor who's not doing anything other than storing my product. Help me get, I'm the one out there actually hiring people to do tastings, or paying for shelf space, premium shelf space and retailers. We'll talk a little bit about that. And then how being able to really move my product, I'm doing all the work, but they're getting more profits out of this thing than I am. I mean, was that your experience as well?
You know, it's interesting. It's a third is the number
right.
For roughly 35% off the top that the distributor gets. And in our case, again, you know, we do have a distributor we use here in Reno, and things are going really well with them. They're an anomaly in that, you know, we're in a smaller market. They're responsive. We've got a brand that's growing pretty well, and we feel like we do get decent attention from them, decent support.
We also love throwing out to the distributor.
That's right. That's right. So thank you to Southern Wine and Spirits.
Right.
But we also do beat the street. We do our own tastings. We make our own sales calls. We're out there seeing our customers, and without that, the brand would not be doing what it's doing, which is growing explosively in this market. We're up more than 200% here in Reno Tahoe this year, and this isn't a new brand. We're 4 years into this, and the brand's still growing really quickly.
Okay, so and really, Matt, you've mentioned it a couple times that what you have is a brand. You've got somebody else manufacturing the vodka for you. How proprietary is that recipe? I mean, so you know, can you get a trademark or any kind of intellectual property on the recipe itself to make this unique blend of vodka? And like, so for example, if the person who's manufacturing for you, you know, they obviously know how to make it because you had to give them the recipe to make it for you. You know, what if they just decided to kind of, hey, we want to make this, you know, instead of Tahoe blue, we're going to make, you know, sapphire green, whatever they, you know, want to call it, but with the same recipe. You know, what, how do you protect your intellectual property on that piece of it?
So there's really two sides to the intellectual property. The first is the USPTO registration we have, right, on the trademark. That's handled. The recipe side, we actually own the recipe. The distiller makes it for us. We worked out a deal early on with them where we bought the recipe free and clear. And it's not only just our specific blend of grape, corn, and sugarcane, but the whole category. So they won't make a grape, corn, and sugarcane vodka for anybody else.
Okay, right.
That being said, the ingredients are right there on the front of the bottle, and I just gave them to you on air. So it's not
50,
a big,
25, 25.
Right. So it's not a big secret. That being said, there's quite a bit of expertise involved in distilling. You'll hear it compared amongst distillers to, you know, almost cooking, or I've also heard piloting. Let's say piloting the still. So there's a lot of skill and a lot of finesse involved. And I mean, think about if you and I, Mike, have ingredients to make a lasagna, we're not going to make the same lasagna, right?
Right.
And so these guys, they make phenomenal vodka. We do have the recipe. If for some reason they shut down, or, you know, their facility was struck by a meteor, we can move production to another facility. We'll take some training to get those guys up and running to make it on par with the quality that we're used to and that our consumers are used to. But we have the recipe end of the business locked up pretty well.
Very, very cool. Let's do this in studio. Matt Levitt, CEO, founder of Tahoe Blue Vodka. We come back, we're going to talk about the Trump tax plan, kind of what that means to you as a business owner. And then also talk about if you're in retirement or considering retirement ever, things you need to do by 12/31 to be able to make a buck or two in tax land. It's Bosmont Business. Newstalk 780 KUH.
Got a business question? Grab the phone and call Mike right now at 852-TALK or 800-564-KKOH. Bosma on Business from News Talk 780 KOH.
Welcome back to Bosma on Business. Your host, Mike Bosma, come to you from the KOH studio. Hey, phone lines are open, 852-8255, 852-TALK. You got some tax questions? I am the tax dude. Don't forget that. My day job, managing partner of Bosma Group CPAs. And more on that after the next segment. Big changes there, so stay tuned. 1-800-564-KKOH. If you still care about long distance, because most cell phones are free, the long distance plan, we can answer your tax questions for free. I mentioned before the break a little bit about the Trump tax plan, what you need to know there. When President Trump was, or I guess President-elect Trump was elected, I remember I, for one, was almost in disbelief. I kind of was a foregone conclusion in my mind that Hillary was going to win. And when that didn't happen, I was kind of had to recalibrate my thinking. That's not an opinion on who should have won or any of the rest of it. I think the stock market has been very clear on, from a business perspective, who they think the better candidate has been or is. But Trump, I've been through his tax plan numerous times on his website from what his campaign platform is. And the big thing that you want to be kind of have your ear to the ground on the Trump tax plan is his promise to reduce tax rates to 15% for C corporations. Now, there was some initial discussion on his platform about reducing S corporation tax rates for S corporation shareholders as well. That was taken out of the more later iterations of his tax plan. But, you know, it really is a quandary, because right now, top marginal tax rate for a C corporation, that's a separate taxpaying entity, 35%. Top marginal tax rate, if it's a flow-through entity, LLC, or S-corporation, sole proprietorship qualifies as well, 39.6%. And you get all your itemized deductions phased out if you're making any amount of cash or any amount of money at all. So you're looking like, well, right now, C-corporation rates are lower than individual rates, which they are. That is true. However, once you distribute out the profits out of that C-corporation, they're rapidly approaching 50%, about 47-48% combined rate once you pay the 34-35% corporate tax and then distribute that out and pay another 15% on what's left. So the Trump tax plan, which, you know, is not hugely controversial, if you ask anybody in the know. Every president, all the going back through George W. Bush, he talked about lowering corporate tax rates to 15%, including current President Obama. It's not necessarily politically expedient, it's just the right thing to do. I work with multinational corporations, and they are kind of astounded at the high corporate tax rate here in the United States. So we plan around that, and that's how come you wonder why General Electric and their ilk are paying closer to 20%, because they hire smart people like our great crew at Bosma Group to be able to help manage that. And there's ways to do that completely legally. So you end up down around that 20% anyway. Well, you know, President-elect Trump and his platform said, hey, if we don't have to play all these games, so that way kind of everybody gets to take advantage of these low rates rather than the people that hire sophisticated tax people. And so I'd say stay tuned. If that tax plan is put into motion, there can be you can see a lot of movement away from S corporations, away from LLCs, into the C corporation land. And it will definitely simplify life for many businesses. But you got to be smart about how you do that. Going from S corporation to C corp, got a plan for that. And in my experience, you end up with multiple entities. So the other thing that you want to be aware of from a tax perspective going into this last 3 weeks of 2016, if you have an IRA or a 401k that, and you're thinking, hey, I'm not really paying tax, I don't care about tax planning, do this thing. I'll tell you, this is the best planning I could ever give you, and that is take that IRA. If you can make a transfer from your 401k to an IRA, do that, but then do a Roth conversion on that IRA. And that basically makes it a taxable transaction in 2016. The beauty, the genius of that planning is you get till the extended due date to decide if you really wanted to do it. So if the stock market tanks, you can unwind it. That's called a recharacterization. If you pay more taxes than you thought, you can unwind a part of it. That allows you to kind of plan to the penny how much you want to pay tax on. Once it's in a Roth IRA, no longer subject to the required minimum distributions and that are going to be taxable every year, that are increasing if you're in Social Security land, collecting Social Security. It's increasing your income, so you're paying tax on your Social Security. I've done a lot of these conversions where you end up, in essence, tax-free for the duration, if you will, until you pass on. And then it passes to your heirs tax-free because they've already been paid tax on. I mean, it is the planning thing that most people aren't even thinking about. The other thing you want to think about, if you're over 70 and a half and making required minimum distributions out of your IRA, go ahead and consider a year-end gift to your favorite charity. If you do a direct contribution from your IRA to that charity, you don't have to take it out of your and pay tax on it and then try and get a charitable contribution. If you're in retirement, you shouldn't have a mortgage. You shouldn't be itemizing deductions. More efficient to do a direct IRA to charity contribution. That way you don't have to take it as a required minimum distribution. And oh, by the way, you know, you don't have to worry about the charitable contribution or recognizing his income, either side of that. So just a little free tax planning, tax advice for you, my loyal listeners. Of course, if you got anything about your specific situation, 852-8255. So that said, speaking of C corporations, Matt Levitt, founder, CEO of Tahoe Blue Vodkas in studio. Now, Matt, you're a C corporation.
That's correct. We're a C corp.
What are your thoughts on the Trump tax plan?
Well, I look forward to potential benefits for us. You know, it takes a year or two to get settled out, but right. You know, at the end of the day, it's all about me, right, Mike?
You know, we can't worry about other people. We only can worry about number one here. Nobody's got our back, right?
Sure. And we really chose C Corp, which is somewhat unusual, I think, for small business because of our emphasis on capital raising and our intent to bring on many shareholders. We're kind of in a perpetual state of capital raising, as a lot of aggressive growth businesses are. And so that was the main reason we chose that route, and additional benefits coming our way, really, I mean, why not? Nothing to complain about here.
Well, yeah, and definitely one of the complexities of having a flow-through type of business structure, S-corporation or LLC, is that these Schedule K-1s go out to the owners, especially if you've got different types. So for just by way of example, we just talked about planning for your IRA or 401k. If that IRA owned a share of Tahoe Blue Vodka and if that K-1 had income on it, it's going to be problematic for that 401k because now they're going to pay tax on that. It's called the unrelated business income tax. And so that's why it's better for those retirement funds to be investing in a C corporation because they can get dividends, but they can't get a pro rata share of business earnings and not pay tax on it. That's kind of the idea. So you ended up because you needed capital. How much capital did you do/do you need? I guess did/do you need?
We're in the midst of a $2 million raise at the moment, and we're probably somewhere in the neighborhood of halfway through that raise.
Okay. And how much before that raise have you capital have you raised to get the monster going?
There was a seed round a couple of years ago that was about $1.2 million.
Okay. So millions of dollars.
Correct.
And that's where I think a lot of people are like, well, why would it take so much capital to get this thing going? So
Marketing, sales, and more marketing.
Right.
And not to mention beefing up the inventory, which is also a big expense. Really, on this capital raise, we're of the 100%, we're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of 55% going towards sales and marketing. Because it's really about creating brand awareness. Like we've got a brand that hits all these kind of really tickles the consumer's fancy on a bunch of levels. It's blended so it tastes better, and it's wheat and gluten free, and it's locally made in Northern California, and we donate a portion of proceeds back to help preserve the lake. So we've got a brand that works. It's proven in Reno, really one of the best selling premium vodkas in the Reno Tahoe market, and just starting to take off like wildfire in Sacramento. So what we need is to create brand awareness, and to do that requires tons of marketing dollars, and that's what we're focusing on. So of that 100%, again, with 55% roughly or so going towards sales and marketing, another 20 to 25% going toward beefing our inventory up to keep up with the demand. What you're left with really is a business that runs pretty lean otherwise.
No, very, very cool. So one of the things that I think most non-business owners kind of revel at is how much capital it takes to get things going. You had to, secure your trademark and then also get your blend going. Inventory, but marketing. So let's do this. We come back. Let's talk about kind of how that all works to grow your empire, and then how you sell a vodka company. Of course, then we'll get to your call right after this break. It's Bosma on Business. News Talk 780 KUH.
Now, back to Bosma on Business. The best financial advice on radio. Money Talk with Bob Brinker, Sunday at 1 p.m. on News Talk 780 KUH.
Welcome back to Bosma on Business. Your host, Mike Bosma, coming to you from the KUH studios. Ho, ho, ho. Happy holidays. Happy Chanukah. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. All of the above, whatever your religious ilk, we just wish you and your family a great holiday season. In studio, Matt Levitt, helping to spread some Christmas cheer himself, founder CEO of Tahoe Blue Vodka, helping to do your own little Christmas cheer.
That's right.
Right? Literally. So one of the things we're looking for is how do you create not only market share, but then how do you capitalize on that? Raised a couple $1 million to get his vodka going. But Matt, everybody's wondering how is a vodka company valued, and how do you exit? Who do you sell to, and how is it valued?
Fair question. You know, the yardstick is cases sold. Number of cases sold in a year is how these brands are valued, not unlike, for example, at .com, it's a number of users. Typically, and there's a ton of merger and acquisition in this industry due to the fact that the more mature brands, the kind of household name brands that you can picture in your head, those labels over the last 20 years are starting to decline in popularity as consumers move to more and more of the craft and small batch. It's not unlike what happened in beer over the last 20, 30 years.
Right,
exactly.
Right.
Same kind of thing. You know, if you go back to the 80s, let's say Miller Coors and Anheuser-Busch had who knows, maybe 80, 90% of the beer market. And then companies like Sierra Nevada came along and Anheuser-Busch said, you can't compete, you don't have the marketing dollars. But here they are years later doing, you know, multiple millions of barrels a year because consumers realize that the product tastes better and they can identify more with it and that there's advantages to switching to these craft brands. So same trend in the spirits industry. It's just about 20 years behind. Mm-hmm. And so... interestingly, the acquiring companies, they're not looking for the business. They don't, they're going to integrate whatever brands they're buying into their own distribution models. They're going to absorb them and probably likely, you know, just take the brand and, you know, take production elsewhere and make it for a third or half of what we're making it for.
Right. And so, all of that percolates, pardon the pun, to the bottom line. So by just, you know, Matt, just to pause there for a quick second. So let's just say for fun, so a third. So let's say you sell, what's the average price point for your vodka?
About $25.
$25. So if you're giving a third to the wholesaler, to the distributor, right? What's on average it costs you to make a bottle?
It costs us about $10 to make a bottle, a 750 ml bottle that includes a ton of taxes. Taxes all over the place. State, federal, local.
Yeah, you'd be shocked as a tax. You think you pay tax on it, yes, at the grocery store. It's taxed heavily to get there. But so let's just say $10. But yeah, you get acquired by a larger brand who has their own distillery, right?
Right.
Then, you know, it's going to drop that probably to half or less.
Not to mention the buying power on the raw material side, right, the buying power for the glass, for the cardboard cartons, for the corks, everything becomes less expensive.
Right.
For
so,
them.
Let's just say for grins that a company's going to, like that distribution company, let's say it's selling for 10 times cash flow. Well, if all of a sudden you're selling 10,000 cases, which is 12,000 bottles or $120,000 bottles, if you can make $5, right, just do the math. Make 120,000 bottles a year at $5 of extra profit, right? So five times 12, $600,000. But at a 10x multiple, that business overnight is worth $6 million more.
Right.
So that's where if you take cash flow, multiply it times 10, their buying power alone, it's worth more. So that's where I think a lot of times people don't understand when they're looking to exit what the synergies is on the purchaser side of it rather than kind of what their own life is on the entrepreneur part of it. What are your thoughts?
And, you know, just as importantly, if you look at the leverage on the distribution channel. So if I was, for example, a Constellation Brands, a Brown-Forman, one of these big conglomerates that owns lots of common liquor brands, and I'm acquiring these craft brands, I'm looking at, okay, these yahoos are doing 10,000 cases in, Reno, Tahoe, Sacramento,
right,
for example. We've got distribution all over the world.
Right. Worldwide, right.
Right. Nationwide first, then worldwide. They said, you know, we can just bang on our distributors to take in, to commit to 5 or 10,000 cases each. And suddenly, you know, they take the brand from 10,000 cases to 100,000 cases.
Like overnight.
Overnight.
Right.
Right. And so that, again, that market penetration, the buying their market share back is really what the acquiring companies are looking for.
Yeah, and that's where, you take that same, you know, that 10,000 case multiple, automatically we're $6 million more, but then, yeah, and then at that same multiple, now you've got 100% of margin that went to your bottom line times, yeah, like you said, 100,000 cases instead of 10,000. So now it's worth $120 million more.
Right.
Overnight.
Exactly.
So that's where you're like, okay, there's a way to, that's why when they buy you, they're not necessarily buying cash flow. You don't need to cash flow.
Right.
So how do they value you?
So they value it in number of cases sold per year. And there's a range you see on these acquisitions. There's quite a bit of this activity. As I said, in this industry, there was two big brands, you know, bigger on the craft side anyway, that were acquired over the last 12 months or so. Deep Eddy Vodka and High West Distilling out of Utah. And, you know, there's this range of number of dollars per case per year of a price tag that the acquiring company is putting on these brands. And that range is anywhere between $1,500 and $4,000 per case per year with an average somewhere in the neighborhood of $2,300, $2,500. And so, for example, High West Distilling, they were doing 60,000 cases last year on their way to probably 70 this year. There's actually a bidding war to take this brand out. Constellation Brands just bought it. There's all kinds of news news articles out there about it right now. But Constellation Brands just bought it for $160 million. And according to the article that went out, press release, they had about 200 employees for a company that's doing, now you start doing the math, right? Wait a second.
Right. Whoa,
they're doing 60,000 cases. You look at the revenue, you know, probably about $12 million per year, and think about the kind of loss they were probably taking
right.
over the years, because there's no way you can be profitable with that many employees with $12 million grossing right. business.
But, excuse me, so, but they were doing their own distilling, right?
They were not.
They were not.
No.
Okay.
No, they were outsourcing their distilling as well. Just bought the brand. Yep.
So, but that's where you look at how to make a buck in these things, and I think that's where a lot of people, they'll say, well, gosh, I can't make any quote unquote money, but you have to look towards the exit, and that's where I consult with business owners as they're looking to buy and sell businesses, and is this a buy and hold strategy? So your investors, you're doing your $2 million capital raise, recognize that you're either going to have to forever be on capital. Be raising capital in order to continue to grow market share, or you'll exit. So, I mean, do you have a preferred method of exit for you?
You know, the business becomes pretty attractively profitable at 10,000-15,000 cases. We're doing close to five, closing in on 5,000 right. this year. And, you know, at that point, suddenly there's no rush to exit, but I think there's a pretty high likelihood the brand's acquired. We've actually already had a couple tire kickers come through and start asking questions about right. volume and the company's finances and production capacity.
Right, that's a good point, because one of the things that I think people are, you know, business owners understand how to run their business, but one of the things they just have no clue or concept of is how to sell their business. And, you know, how much is too much information? You know, you don't want to give all the corporation's secrets away. And if you spend all your time talking to tire kickers, you can't grow the business.
Right.
So, and I would imagine, Matt, you're plenty busy, raising capital and running the business. Those are two full-time jobs. But I think that's where a lot of times I've found that, you know, over 10 years, lifespan of Bosma Group, we've acquired four CPA firms along the way, and have talked to, you know, gosh, scores of CPA firms about merging and doing business. And it's fascinating. The more you talk to people, the smarter you are about your own business. Because, you know, as you're doing due diligence or having those conversations, even if they're very casual ones, you know, like, do you get an appetite for what they're looking for, what matters to them on the acquisition side, if you're looking to sell, or if you're looking to acquire? Kind of the same thing. It's like you're getting, you know, good intel on, gosh, I didn't realize, you know, we're paying a buck a cork, you know, for example, and, you know, they source their corks for a nickel. You know, let's do that. You know, mm-hmm. It's just, you get smarter every time you have those discussions. Trying to weigh between operations and buying and selling different verticals in your business model. So, and that's where I think, Matt, as we look at Tahoe Blue, is where is the terminal point? Where do you see this thing going? Is it, you know, how big can it be? Is it just a regional play, or is it a nationwide play?
You know, Chevy's got a truck that uses the Tahoe name pretty well, and not only nationally but internationally. Mm-hmm. You know, Tahoe as a vodka, which really kind of is a play on this clear, pure, smooth waters relationship of, you know, premium vodka right. to Lake Tahoe, and also the lifestyle that's associated with Tahoe, right? Part of this brand is that we want to take the consumer to Tahoe when they see a bottle and they grab a bottle, not unlike when you think of beach, when you think of Corona beer, for example.
Right.
So does it play best in states where the consumer knows and loves Tahoe? Of course it does. So that's, mm-hmm. you know, California, Nevada first, and then Western states. But really, Tahoe's recognized, as I said, nationally and internationally, and I think it works. It's going to take probably more marketing dollars.
You got to feed the monster.
Right.
More marketing dollars.
You got to educate the consumer. You got to first teach them what Tahoe is and what it's about, and then draw the connection, I think. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for us, we're just focused really on Northern California, Northern Nevada for now, because there's plenty of market here for us. You know, we've got a good few years worth of work before we'd consider expanding into other markets.
Well, yeah, and that's where, you know, I've had, numerous alcohol manufacturers, distributors, on the show. And I think that, you know, like, for example, we think of Battleborn beer. You've been to Hawaii. We were talking about that before the show. I just got back literally this morning. Five this morning I got in. Oh, goodness sakes. Okay. I'm a little rummy. But when you look at, how those brands developed, Battleborn, the beer in Nevada. And I got, you know, so when you go to Hawaii, what beer do you drink? Do you drink beer?
Yeah, I do. I love beer. I love craft beer. And usually I go to, you know, the Kona Brewing.
Right. You go to Kona, right? Or like, you know, I think, you know, like a Longboard, something mm-hmm. like that. So,
right.
You know, and that's where, like, on this product, if you can kind of create this experience really around the lake. And I think we call it, when I was in Hawaii, our flip-flop experience, right? I can put on my flip-flops anytime I grab a Longboard or a Kona. You want that same experience when somebody pours a Tahoe Blue. Let's do this. We come back. The number one thing when you're starting your own liquor company, it's Bosma on Business News Talk 780 KUH.
Need one-on-one advice? Schedule a complimentary one-hour consultation with Mike and his team of advisors at 775-786-4900. Bosma on Business from News Talk 780 KUH. This is Bosma on Business, the where, what, and now of Reno. Mornings 5 to 9 with Ross and Monica on News Talk 780 KOH.
Welcome back to Bosma on Business. It's your host, Mike Bosma. Da-da-da-dum. Talking to you about your business. You know what? I love doing our one-on-one consultations. Our loyal listeners coming in like, hey, gosh, how, it seems like, Mike, you've kind of got the angle. You understand how to play the game on getting more cash out of the business and really now how to diversify away from your business that, you know, creates your livelihood, pays the bills. Then how do I create an exit strategy with that so that way I can transition into retirement? And, of course, nobody ever retires anymore. In fact, a lot of people that will come in for those free one-hour consultations will say, hey, I don't want to retire. I'm going to work forever. I'm like, which is awesome. But what happens if you can't? Or what happens if you don't want to? What happens if, you know, like just mentioned, you just got back from Hawaii and just like, maybe I just want to do this for a little while. It's the ability to diversify away from your business so that you have enough other wealth or enough recurring revenue in your business that doesn't require you being part of it so that you can go sit on a beach somewhere and decompress or do another adventure. Maybe, you know, I'm a man of faith. Maybe I want to go into the mission field and help, you know, orphans in Kenya, whatever, you know, that you can do that. In fact, that's, you know, a good read for you, Ben Franklin's autobiography. You know, when he got into being a statesman, a citizen statesman, he sold a half of his business to somebody, and the income that he got from that half of the business, allowed him to be able to be he called it a man about town, and to be able to do some things and to give back. And so, yeah, there's reasons that you want to do that. And maybe that's where you want to come in and take advantage of, hey, this, equation that I've got seems to have fine tuned to be able to help people diversify away from the business, even if they still own the business, but they have enough other wealth. And the only way to do that is through efficient tax planning because rates are so high. So we leave our listeners with our number one thing in studio, Matt Levitt, founder, CEO, Tahoe Blue Vodka. So Matt, you know, you're starting up your liquor company, your distribution and really brand company. What would you leave our listeners with? What's the number one takeaway they need to think about if they're going to open up that kind of a business?
You know, Mike, I think the biggest takeaway from the whole experience for me has been, look, I'm an idea guy. First, right? I dreamt this brand up. I woke up one morning in early 2011. I turned to my wife and said, I had this dream about this vodka that, you know, I described the bottle and it captures the essence of Lake Tahoe and all the things mm-hmm. I've been telling you about the brand. That's one of, I don't know, hundreds to thousands of ideas for products. I've had them ever since I was, you know, 12, 13 years old. I remember modifying my toys when I was a kid.
Right.
Right. And thinking, how come, you know, I have to drill holes in this Frisbee to put lights in it to make it glow? How come they don't make a Frisbee right. that already has right. lights in? So we all have product ideas. Everybody listening to this show has ideas for products. And I think overcoming the inertia of not doing anything about those ideas is really like the biggest step. It's going from, okay, I have an idea for a new widget, whether it's a better tool or windshield wiper or whatever it is, kind of getting off your butt, putting together a plan, sourcing out the parts and identifying a distribution model that'll work really as a starting point and kind of creating this roadmap of where you need to go to get from here to there. Is, you know, the biggest challenge. And I would say, you know, if you've got an idea out there, just act on it. Let's do something with it.
Well, and that's I'd say, but, you know, my number one takeaway is, you know, make sure you've got the right mousetrap, the right widget. You know, everybody has an idea. Don't necessarily act on the first one. Do your due diligence and act on the right one. You know, whether or not it's going to stick or not. A lot of that is kind of getting some traction out in the marketplace. That's what you did, kind of got it locally, got some traction, and said, hey, we've got something. So let's do this. Next week, I've got more entrepreneurs, more advisors, more business expertise. Give us a call, 786-4900, if you want to be able to be part of this success story that is the legacy of kind of this show, Bosma on Business. We can make that magic happen. 786-4900, it's Bosma on Business. News Talk 780. KOH.
On air, online, on demand. News Talk 780 KOH.